Subject is Midrash. What is Midrash? Is a body of works written by the rabbis who composed the Mishnah. Now the rabbis throughout the generations have written commentaries on the Torah and on legal areas, etc. So one of the most famous of the commentaries on the Torah, the prophets and the writings is called Midrash, and really there are something like 60 different collections of Midrashim, the most famous being the Midrash Rabbah and the Midrash Tanchuma, are the two most famous Midrashim. These Midrashim, at least in composition, date back in written form to about 170, 200 CE, 200 of the Common Era, in other words, 1,800 years ago. And they date back to a period of the Mishnah. Now, there is often a lot of misunderstanding about Midrash. What is Midrash out to do? And this prompted me. Someone once asked me in a class, Rabbi, I said a story, and they said, Rabbi, is that a Midrash or is it true? And they asked this in all innocence, and to me it was... What do you mean? Because I look at the Midrash as true. But what do we mean by true? You see, there is literal truth and there is metaphor. And what I'd like to try to show is what the methodology of the Midrash is. Is the Midrash there to teach me something? And it does it in ways which are employ things like metaphor, or is everything there to be taken literally? So there's a metaphor about metaphor. Number one, it's in the Song of Songs. It tells us that one of the first person to write what's called a Midrash of some sort was King Solomon. King Solomon wrote a book called Mishlei. Mishlei means the Book of Proverbs. King Solomon's Book of Proverbs, the Midrash says the following. It says, the Torah until King Solomon, much of it was inaccessible. Different people have different intellectual abilities. Different people process information differently. Different people perceive things differently. How is it that you can convey Torah to so many different people? How can you satisfy every person's desire to understand in their own way, every person's different ways of processing? How can you do such a thing? So they said it's a metaphor for, let's say you have a deep well. A deep well with lots of clear water in it, but it's too deep for anyone to get. So everyone's got string. You know, so some guy's got a belt, some guy's got his shoe strings, shoelaces, and someone else has got like a fishing line, and someone else got a thick cable. None of them by themselves can reach the water. What you have to do, therefore, is to tie the fishing line. You can't tie to a giant hawser, like 6-inch hawser that a tugboat uses, right? You've got to tie it to the shoelace. And the shoelace you tie to the string, and the string you tie to this, and eventually you connect all of them together. That's really what the rabbis wanted to do in Midrash, which is to tie everyone's mind, everyone's rope, to the wellsprings of Torah, to somehow bring the words of Torah up from the deep well into people's minds and consciousnesses, and to do it in such a way that it will be palatable and understandable to people on many different levels. This, in fact, also, the Zohar, great, probably also, you could look at the Zohar as a Midrash, but it's a Midrash based on Kabbalah, on Jewish mysticism. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says, if you think that the Torah is just telling you stories, you are missing the point. He says, stories, an author could write better stories than the Torah. As a work of literature and fiction, there could be greater works of literature and fiction, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says. Rather, he says, there is what we call a higher spiritual world and a lower physical world. And when something comes into the physical world, it has to come in the physical form. When the angels came to visit Abraham, what did they look like? They looked like men. They looked like men. Things in the physical world have got to be physical. They have to have a physical body to encompass the soul, just like the soul has to have a body which can encompass and contain the soul in the physical world. So spiritual truths also need some physical body to have them exist in this world. The stories of the Torah, he says, are the body to the soul. There's a soul to the story, and there's a body to the story. Very often, we become too fixated with the body to understand the soul. I remember once, when I was a rabbi in Toronto, I was reading Grey's Anatomy, which was the standard guide to human anatomy. It's a, I found it interesting. But anyway, so one of the things I was looking at the jaw, the structure of the jaw. Anyway, fellow comes into my office, made an appointment. He wanted to schmooze with me, wanted to talk to me. So he comes into the office, and we're sitting there talking, and I'm looking at his face, and I'm kind of like imagining the bone and muscle structure underneath. And he's talking about something very serious, and as he's talking, I notice that there's a slight click in his jaw. I wonder what that is. There's some condition I remember like that, where there's a little click as you move it, click in the jaw. And I try to imagine the jawbone and the muscles and all that type of stuff. Anyway, after about, I'm fascinated by this, you know what I mean? I'm looking at him, like, intently. And after about 10 minutes, he says, so, what do you think I should do, Rabbi? And I said, that's why I go to a dentist, right? And I said to him, look, maybe if you told me your problem in different words, it would be, it would be easier. You see, my problem was, I was so focused on the physical that I ignored the inner sense, the spiritual. But we do that all the time. We do that with other people. You know, sometimes someone's beauty can be blinding. So you can't think of anything else? I always love this story about a good friend of mine who's a rabbi, I won't say where, and you'll see why. And it was a Friday afternoon, and he was in a bad mood beyond all imagination. He said the hot water broke down, he had four kids that needed showers for Shabbos, and he was trying to get a plumber to come and fix the gas hot water. He said, in addition, he had realized at last minute he forgot to prepare a sermon, and there was a big bar mitzvah in the shul, and the person who normally read the Torah called him sick. Rabbi, can you read the Torah? So you can imagine that he was not in a good mood. So he says then, to make it worse, it's an hour before Shabbos. He's going out of his mind, right? The doorbell rings. He marches over to the door. Basically, he's going to rip it open and you know, who knows what he's going to do to the person there. So he pulls the door open, and there's this very beautiful woman standing there. And she says, hi, Rabbi, am I disturbing you? He says, no, not at all. No, just come in and sit down. She says, were you busy? He says, no. Never do anything Fridays. It's like, so she sits down. And she is the mother of the bar mitzvah boy. And her ex-husband is coming to the bar mitzvah, his son. And her ex-husband's parents are coming to the bar mitzvah. It's their grandson. And she says, she's like talking about how would it be possible, and she's prepared to compensate the shul for lost donations, to possibly make sure that none of the father's family get any honor in the synagogue on the son's bar mitzvah. I mean, look, there's no obligation. Is there any religious obligation for the father to have a call up on his son's bar mitzvah? Not really. And the grandfather, I mean, you know, it's going to be difficult for him to get up there. And you know, I'm sure they'll give donation. I'm prepared to, you know, match anything they'll give, you know. And he says, the more she talked, the more ugly she became. He says it reminded him of a science fiction movie, V. Anyone see that? You had these aliens that invaded Earth, right? And every time they get together by themselves, these idiots, right, would start pull off their masks, which are humans. And underneath is this hideous reptile. Of course, you can't have a movie without that, because how would anyone know they're aliens? You know, someone looking through the crack when they put, I mean, if the aliens were smart, they'd never take off the disguise. Right? But anyway, they took off the disguise. He says, but as she's talking, he can see these layers of skin peeling away, and this hideous reptile coming out. How can I destroy my ex-husband, right? How can I rip apart the kid's bar mitzvah, make sure his father has no part in it, and so on and so forth? And he realized, he says, what's he doing? He's looking at the body and ignoring the soul. But the soul comes through. So Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says, when we look at the stories of the Torah, we do the same thing. We're sometimes so fixated on the story, we don't see, we don't perceive the soul of the matter which is coming through. What the Midrash tries to do is to bring out the soul of the matter. And really, the Talmud says, number three, the Talmud says the following. It says, it talks about a particular story, a Midrash that it mentions, Agadata in the Talmud, and it tells us a story about someone, and it says, his father's name and his mother's name. His name and his father's name. It actually also mentions where he came from. So the Talmud says, why does it mention his name and his father's name? So the Talmud answers, in order to inform us that the story is not a metaphor. Now, let's use some logic here. What is the implication then of what would be the normal status quo? Normal status quo is, would the story be a metaphor? The implication is that the factory setting, the pin switches of Talmud are that its story is a metaphor unless you are told otherwise. So if there's specific information given, okay, it's not a metaphor. But what's going to be my base assumption otherwise? That the idea is a metaphor. What is a metaphor? Because in the everything we speak about is metaphor. Humans work through symbols. That's, I think, one of the most beautiful aspects of the Torah. Is the utilization of simple physical things to encapsulate spiritual truths. Think of everything behind matzah. All the ideas, the liberation of the Jewish people and freedom and oppression and monotheism and humility and everything else, and it's all encapsulated in this like upholstered cardboard thing that you're gonna, it's a very beautiful thing. You think of what's in a mezuzah. Monotheism, love of God, Torah study, commandments, reward and punishment, chosenness, land of Israel, etc., etc. All encapsulated in this very, very, just on the door. Type of like sculpture. Judaism is like sculpture. Like Rodin took the concept of thought and encapsulated it in a statue. Judaism takes the soul of the matter, the spiritual, and encapsulates it in the physical. So we can relate to it. So really, that's what the Midrash is doing, and that's what a metaphor is. And this, the Maharal, probably the greatest scholar of Midrash that ever lived, the Maharal writes, you will see that most of the words of the sages were in the form of metaphor and analogies of the wise. Unless they state that a particular story is not a metaphor, it should be assumed that it is. Matters of great depth were generally expressed by the sages using metaphors and should be understood as metaphors unless they are explicitly indicated to be taken literally. Therefore, one should not be surprised to find matters in the words of the sages that appear to be illogical and distant from the mind. He says, we often, people see things in the words of the sages, oh, come on. Is that what they really meant? The answer is no, it's not what they really meant. What they really meant, though, is couched in the stories. Now, why would they communicate like this? Why can't you just say it directly? Why not just say it out straight? So there's a few reasons for this. First of all, not everyone will understand it. Some people only understand things on the most base, on the most obvious level. Some people are just not subtle in the way they think. Right? Secondly, some information is not ideal for everyone to know at every single point in their life. Fourth, freedom of information, freedom of speech is very basic, but, right, you don't want, for instance, let's say, if you go onto the internet, you know you can download from the internet, the International Terrorism Handbook, which will teach you how to pick locks, construct bombs from homemade materials. It's on the internet, it's freely available, right? You can, you know, you can download, instructions of how to, you know, make all types of weapons. It's unbelievable. It's about freedom of information. Well, I don't think that information should be in the hands of everyone. Maybe it's not a good idea. Who will decide? I don't know. That's not my problem at the moment. I'm just pointing out, not all information is intrinsically good for everyone at all times in their life. People can't handle certain information. So therefore, the sages put it in such a way that when you can handle it, that's probably when you'll understand it. Right? In other words, if we have a metaphor, then, you know, it'll sit in your mind, and then maybe at a later stage in your life, you'll look back and say, oh, that's what he meant. That has happened sometimes, you know, especially when a parent says something. My father says something, and then like 10 years later, I look back and say, that's what Dad meant. That's unbelievable. Mark Twain used to say, right? He says, until I was 18, he says, I thought my father was a fool. He says, by the time I was 20, I was shocked how much he'd learnt in 2 years. And really, that's the way it is. So he may have, maybe he'll say me, say this, say that, whatever it is. But, I used to walk in, my father used to do a lot of carpentry. I don't know, he probably still does, as far as I know. And, so I would walk in and I'd say, what's that? And he'd tell me, and I'd say, it doesn't look like it's going to work very well. And he'd like say something in Russian. And I'd say, what did that mean? Doesn't matter, right? So I found out later what it meant was, don't show a fool half-finished work. I said, oh, that's what he meant. Half-finished work, the fool asks, well, hey, this is not going to work, right? You have to realize there's a plan here. So anyway, there's an idea that you look back. When you get to a certain level, you will understand. That's the idea. So now, what I'd like to do is, in order to, I suppose, make it more tangible, bring it out, I'd like to give some examples of some rather bizarre statements which the sages make. And let's see what the real meaning of it is. The first, of course, just very briefly, I've got a quote here in parentheses in number 4. The sages in the Talmud say the evil inclination... You know, if you imagine, what does the evil inclination look like? The desire for evil in the human being. I always used to imagine the evil inclination looked like Jabba the Hutt. You ever seen Jabba the Hutt? Right. So Star Wars? No, no one's familiar with this. Okay, not a literary audience, are we? Okay. All right, so, fine. So anyway, of course, it's not the Star Wars of literature. But anyway, so Jabba the Hutt is like this like slime being, you know, with a narrow slit of a mouth, you know, like, bring me more food, you know, that type of thing, right? That's how you imagine, like, So the truth is, the sages say, the evil inclination looks like a fly. Now you think of it, looks like a fly. Zvuvei mavet yav ishun, shemen rokeach, says in parables, in Proverbs, that the flies of death. So the fly, by the way, you may have been familiar. Anyone read Lord of the Flies? Lord of the Flies is a translation of a Hebrew term, Baal Zavuv, or in English, Beelzebub. Right? Beelzebub, Satan worshippers, used to worship the image of a fly. The Hebrew for Baal means Lord or Master, or as an ancient deity, and Zavuv is a fly. So if you've ever heard the term Beelzebub, right, it means from the Hebrew, which is the fly. So it's interesting that the sages say the evil inclination looks like a fly, and Satan worshippers throughout history, they used to worship the image of a fly. I find that amazing. I mean, that's very, you know, they're both hit, of course, from different sides of the spectrum, right? So you can know, as the Maharal says, sometimes you can know light from darkness. Yediat ha'hefechim emet, knowledge of the opposite is also true. I know the opposite, I can know from the opposite what the truth is. So, the fly. Now, what is it about a fly that's significant with the evil inclination? Is it that it's annoying? The evil inclination is annoying. It's annoying. But I think there's maybe more to it than that. You see, like this. Originally, in creation, in the 6 days of creation, right, there's one day, every day, what does it say every day? And God saw that it was good. There's one day it doesn't say that. What day does it not say God saw that it was good? On the second day of creation. On the second day of creation, it doesn't say good. It does not say good. Why? What happened on the second day of creation? So, if you look in Genesis, it says that on the second day God separated, split apart the waters below and the waters above. The Talmud says the second day of creation was the creation of separation. The separation of the higher world from the lower world. The heavenly waters from the earthly waters. The physical from the spiritual. The day in which separation was created is a day in which it doesn't say good. It doesn't say good. What day does it compensate for that? On the third day of creation, it says God saw it was good twice. Because on the third day of creation was the linkage of the higher and the lower. Because what happened on the third day? The weather system, the rain and the plants. What does that all do? That's the linkage of the higher water and the lower water. So the Gaon of Vilna tells us an important principle in Judaism. Any time you want to know the definition of a term, you have to look at the first place it's ever mentioned. If the first place it's mentioned, it means this, that is what it always consistently means throughout the Torah. The first place good is mentioned teaches us what? That what does good actually mean? Tov, good, what would it mean? If the second day of creation was separation, splitting, and it doesn't say good, and the third day was the joining, and it says good twice, what does that tell me about the word good? What does it mean? Unity. The joining together of two things. What therefore would be evil? Separation. So now, joining together because we believe that the ultimate good is the human being joining together with the Creator, with God. One human being joining together with another, and the body, the physical, joining with the soul. Our concept of good is really unity. In order to get to that unity under our own power, God split things apart. He created disunity. He created a split. But the purpose of the split was so that we, under our own power, could bring everything together. So he split the soul of Adam into so many different souls, split them all apart. He split the human being into male and female. He split the heaven and the earth. He separated all these things. Why? So that all of those things will seek out the unity with their other half, with the other part, with the other aspect. That's the essence of good. The evil inclination, therefore, means that which will separate, that which will split you from your soul, that which will split you from your other half, that which will separate you from other people and separate you from God. That's the essence of the evil inclination. The evil inclination thrives on decomposition, on the splitting apart. Very much like a fly. The fly, what does the fly do? The fly lives from... it lives from death. It lives wherever there is decomposition, wherever the elements are splitting apart, wherever the soul has left the body, or there is a wound, or there is a decomposition, or there is something rotting, there is something decaying. That is where you will find the fly. The fly thrives on decay and decomposition. And hence, the rabbis said if you wanted to symbolize the evil inclination, which is the desire to be apart from God, apart from others, apart from the self, the splitting apart of things. Where would you look? How would you symbolize it? How would you encapsulate it? The fly. Because the fly thrives on the decomposition of matter. And that's really what the rabbis meant. How did the rabbis say it? The rabbi said it, the evil inclination looks like a fly. So a person looks at that and says, oh yeah, right. Right, that's the fly. So I'll use fly spray and I'll be a righteous person. That's not what the rabbis meant. The rabbis assumed that we knew the meaning of the word good and assumed that we knew the meaning of the word evil. And they assumed that it would be obvious. But even if it wasn't obvious, maybe there'd be a lesson for us, someone else. So there's an idea that the rabbis are telling us, which is, in the word fly, or in the idea of fly, is the opposite of the word good. And that's the concept of the evil inclination. It's the desire to separate. It's ego. What's ego? It's the opposite of the spiritual. Spiritual means giving, means the desire to incorporate, to unite. Ego, the physical, is the desire to take, to consume. The betterment of the self, the selfish gene, Richard Dawkins called his book about human evolution. The selfish gene. And indeed he's right. From a purely materialistic point of view, it is selfish. That's what life is about. But that's not what the spiritual is about. The spiritual is about joining together, not splitting apart. So that's the idea the rabbis meant. A second midrash. Number 6. This is quite famous. It says the following. When Jacob left. You know, everyone's familiar with Jacob was the grandson of Abraham. Now, Jacob's brother Esau was the evil twin. And the blessings that were meant to go to Esau went instead to Jacob. Jacob, on the command of his mother, stole the blessings from Esau. But God said he was right. He was justified in doing so. He took the blessings from Esau. Now, what's interesting is, Esau then says, he swears he's going to kill Jacob. He says, I swear I will kill him. So what does Jacob do? The smart thing. He runs away. Right? And he leaves his father's home, he leaves Israel, and he goes away from Israel. Now, on the way out there, it says the following. It says he gets to a place called Beit El. And in Beit El, now read the Hebrew, read the English carefully, number 6. It says this, he took from the stones of the place and placed them under his head. I've made it easy. I've italicized and bold-faced. He took the stone that he had placed under his head and made it into a monument. Do you see a discrepancy here? Mm-hmm. What's the discrepancy? That's right. How many stones did he take? It says he took from the stones of the place, that's plural. And in the morning, he wakes up, he takes the stone that he placed under his head, and he made it into a monument. That's a strange thing. Was it one stone? Was it many stones? I mean, I love the stones myself. Fred and Wilma, right? But again, Mick Jagger, right? But what is it? What's going on with the stones? Right? Is it one stone? Is it many stones? So, Rashi answers a very strange answer. Rashi says, you know what? It was many stones originally. But as soon as Jacob put his head on the stone, he says, first of all, he took all these stones. The stones were all arguing amongst themselves. Which we know they do, right? Mick and everyone, right? You know, right, the stones are all so they're all arguing amongst themselves. All the stones are arguing. Jacob puts his head on the stones, and God makes all the stones into one big happy rock. So we've got a discrepancy in the Bible where it says that Jacob took many stones, and then in the morning it says he had one stone. And then, Rashi, through a midrash, attempts to explain it. Don't worry, folks, I'll explain it. Now it'll be clear to you. It wasn't many. At first, it was many stones. But all the stones were saying, hey, I want the guy to rest his head on me. Right? I want the tzaddik, the righteous person, to rest his head on me. So God sees all the stones are quarreling. So what does he do? Makes them into one stone. Now, what are we meant to understand from this? He is so righteous, he brought them together. Very beautiful lesson. Very possible. Very possible. Right? One idea, we'll get further into that. On the simplest level, it may be, on the simplest level, there's one of the commentaries said, look, very simple. Every human being is like a stone. Everyone's like a stone. He says, now, the possibility is that when you do a mitzvah, you do a kindness, why do we do it? What's our motivation? Sometimes the motivation is ego gratification. Self-gratification, enlightened self-interest. Sometimes it's altruistic. He says, how do we know when it's altruistic? How do we know when it's not? What will be the litmus test? So one of these rabbis says the following. Let's imagine someone is in the, some stranger walks into the synagogue Friday night. Stranger walks into the synagogue Friday night, and I walk over to him and I say, hi, would you like to come for dinner tonight? And he looks at me and says, it's okay, thank you very much, the Goldbergs already invited me. So I walk away and I say, that's wonderful. And I walk away and I say, curse them. Every single guest, they always chop him first. Not once have I ever got someone. Every time I go to someone, the Goldbergs always get him. Right? So I have a great dislike for Goldberg, because Goldberg always gets my guests. So now, what's the idea here? Is the reason that I am inviting the person for ego gratification, or is the reason I'm inviting him is because altruistically I want this person to have a place to live, to have a place to eat on Friday night? Well, it depends. If I have a great feeling of animosity towards Goldberg, that's a sign that it's my ego at work here. Right? If, maybe get him a drink of water, maybe, or something like that. Okay, if I have a feeling of animosity towards Goldberg, that's clearly a sign of my ego. If, on the other hand, right, my feeling towards Goldberg is that that's wonderful. It's wonderful. That's great. It means that it's more altruistic. If I have a positive feeling towards Goldberg, then I'm more altruistic. In other words, you've got the possibility a person does something, right? When a person does something, they do it. Maybe it's for ego, maybe it's for altruism. So it depends. If I'm a rock and I am all by myself, I think of it in terms of Simon and Garfunkel. Right? Simon and Garfunkel said, what is a person? What was their song?
I am a rock.
I am a rock. I am an island. Okay, if I look at myself as a rock and as an island, then indeed I have a bad feeling when someone else gets the mitzvah, when someone else gets the guest, or whatever it happens to be. Right? Because I want to do it myself. On the other hand, if instead of Simon and Garfunkel, I've been reading John Donne, and when I read John Donne, he says, no man is an island entirely of itself, every man is a part of the continent, a piece of the main, then I say to myself, ah, if he's resting his head there, it's on me as well. Because we are all part of the same unit. Therefore, that's the metaphor. That's on a very simple level. The metaphor is the following. Every stone, every person, looks out for themselves and quarrels. Let him rest on me, let him rest on me. Because they don't look at themselves as part of the same stone. There is hatred, there is jealousy, because we all look at ourselves as separate units. If we would understand ourselves as part of the same units, we wouldn't have that hatred, wouldn't have that jealousy, wouldn't have the ego. Like the prohibition of revenge. Right? Why is it prohibited to take revenge? Because we're part of one unit. Imagine, I'm hammering in a nail. So I do this. Wham! Oh, I hit my thumb. So in order to compensate, I take the hammer in this hand, put this thumb down, like wham! This is the hand that did it. It deserves punishment. Right? Because it hit this thumb. It's only right that this hand should hit that thumb. Is that stupid? I mean, how stupid is that, for heaven's sakes? Right? You have to realize, guess what? Both hands are the same body. They're the same body. Right? You're not going to help it by hurting both parts of the body. So the answer here is the same idea. The rocks are quarreling amongst themselves, and when they quarrel amongst themselves, it's a result of the fact that they look at themselves as individual rocks. They're Simon and Garfunkel, right? However, right, the more literary rocks, John Donne, right, they'll look at themselves as a part of the continent. I'm a part of everyone else. It's one unit. And therefore, they'll get together and won't feel that way. That's on a very simple level. But there's another level beyond that. And that's what the Maharal explains. The Maharal says the following. A rock in Hebrew, Evan in Hebrew, the word Evan actually is related to another word. Evan is related to the word binyan. Evan is a stone. What is binyan?
Building.
A building. You take many stones and put them together, what you get is a binyan, a building. Right? So Evan, a stone, is the building block of creation. He says, now, when a person looks at the world, you look at the physical world, what do you see in the physical world? So if you look into nature, do you see, at least superficially, do you see harmony? Or do you see a struggle for survival? So if you look into nature, you see whales eating millions of plankton every day. And then, of course, you see a giant squid, because you would never actually have seen this, but a giant squid killing the sperm whale, which has eaten millions of plankton. And then maybe a human being will kill the squid and make calamari. And then, who knows, microbes will try to eat the human being from inside out. It's a continual struggle for survival. Continual struggle for survival. Every aspect of nature, people look at it and they see one thing against the other. One thing challenging each other, one thing contradicting each other. Every single element of creation looks to a person on a superficial view as they are opposed to each other. Totally opposed to each other. And that's really the superficial view. So you look at the stones, meaning stones, building blocks of the building of creation, And many people look at it and all they see is a lack of unity. A struggle for... Malthus saw this, right? Many people see this. All they see is the struggle for survival. They see one thing arguing with each other. However, if you have a deeper view of things, you will see that inherently there is a pattern here. You will see harmonies beneath the surface. You will see algorithms that explain this and that. You will see rules that explain this. And the deeper view of creation, the deeper view of the world, sees harmony. The righteous person, indeed, when they put their head to it, they can see harmony in the world. The head of the righteous person is that which unites. That's what all of Judaism, by the way. We believe that the monotheistic worldview is precisely that. What is the monotheistic worldview? It says the following. If you have this phenomena, and that phenomena, and that phenomena, and that phenomena, monotheism, you know what paganism will say, well, that happened because of Zeus. And that happened because of Zoroaster. That happened because of Ahura Mazda. And that happened because of Khnum. All separate. Every rock is arguing with each other. Why did the volcano explode? We didn't chuck enough ladies in last week. That's how they look at it. Right? Why did this happen? Because of that. Why did this happen? Because of that. Everything's separate. Monotheism says, you know why this happened? Draw a line through this. Put an X and a Y axis in, and we can map the things and show that it's a mathematical function. We can show that there's a pattern here. That's what that's the beauty of monotheism. The beauty of monotheism was, and this perhaps is why, I read recently an article by a sociologist who discussed, the question was, why Newton did not come from China? Why is he asking that question? Because in China and India, there were brilliant people. Technologically, they were very advanced. They had philosophers, they had many brilliant people in China and India. Why is it that the basis of all modern science does not come from India or China? Where does it come from? Newton, Einstein, Niels Bohr, Oppenheimer, so on and so forth. What's interesting is he says the following. He says, because they came from Bible-based societies. Societies in which there was a monotheistic worldview as opposed to a pagan worldview. The pagan worldview is one of disunity. All the rocks are quarreling with each other. This is going that way, this is going that way, this is going that way, this is going that way. There's no unity. Polytheism, what does polytheism mean? It means that every single thing, every force is controlled by a different god. That's what polytheism is. A polytheistic society does not look for patterns. In the polytheistic society, this is under his sphere of influence, his sphere of influence, his sphere of influence, his sphere of influence. You don't look for a pattern. You cannot draw a line through. The polytheist looks at the world and sees disunity. They see one stone arguing with each other. That's all they see. The monotheistic worldview looks at the world and is looking for patterns, is looking for the line to draw through it. It's a beautiful principle. It's a principle of monotheism. And that's why Judaism is not contradictory and is not contradicted by science. On the contrary, we feel that the more patterns, the more explanations, the more algorithms, the more formulae, the more equations that explain how to draw the line through the points, all lead me to believe that there is an intelligence, a designer, and a creator behind everything we see. That's the idea of unity. So therefore the rocks, which are the building blocks of creation, those blocks, or rocks, were arguing with each other. What does it mean they were arguing with each other? Each one appeared to be engaged in a struggle for its own survival with its separate power and its separate sphere of influence. Now, what happened? When did they become united? When Jacob put his head on them. What do you think the head of Jacob symbolizes? What's the head of Jacob? When you say someone's got a good head, what do you mean? I had a karate instructor had a great head. He could break bricks with it. You go, bam, break a brick. Does that mean a good head? When you say someone's a good head, do you mean they have a thick skull? No. You mean the opposite. Right, exactly. Right? The karate instructor, not that I'd say this to his face, had a thick skull. He didn't have a good head. Right? A good head means the intellect. So Jacob represents, he's the third of the patriarchs. Jacob, it says, Titain Emet, truth to Jacob. Emet, the Hebrew word truth, Aleph Mem Taf. Aleph is the first letter of the alphabet. Taf is the last letter of the alphabet. Mem is in the middle of the alphabet. Truth, what does that mean? Truth is that which links together everything. The beginning, the middle, the end. You draw a line through it. That's what truth is. Jacob represents, we also find the Kabbalists tell us that Abraham's attribute was kindness. Chesed le'Avraham. Abraham is called Isha Chesed, the man of kindness, the giver. But he was an extreme of kindness. And then Yitzchak, his son Isaac, is the Kabbalists say he represented the attribute of justice, strict justice. So you've got one extreme is giving, kindness. The other extreme is strict justice. And who is the one that linked those two together? The third of the patriarchs, Jacob. Jacob was Emet, who linked the extremes together. So therefore it's appropriate that the head of Jacob, when it rests on the stones, what does it do to the stones? It turns them into one. It shows us the inherent unity within those stones. That is what the rabbis are trying to teach us. They are trying to teach us that when we look at the world in its superficial reality, we have to understand that what we see is disunity. What we need is belief in God and the monotheistic system that will give us the ability to see the unity in the world. There's a book by Albert Einstein called Out of My Later Years, essays he wrote in his old age. One of the essays is called Science and Religion. In the essay, Einstein says a wonderful thing. He says, science can only be created by those imbued with a desire for truth and understanding. He says that desire stems from the sphere of religion, not from science. He says, furthermore, he says it can only be created, no universal formula. No formula of universal application could be created without a belief that the world that we observe is rational and comprehensible to the human mind. The idea that the world we observe is rational and comprehensible to the human mind springs from the sphere of religion. It may be subconscious in the mind of the scientist. It may be subconscious in the person. But if you are looking for patterns, what is your assumption? Your assumption is that there is a designer. Because if there's no designer, what are you looking for patterns for? You walk into a room, some nutcase went into a room with a baseball bat and started smashing things all over the room. And I walk in there, art critic, and I walk in there and say, oh, beautiful. Let's call this rage. So, are you looking for a pattern? I mean, no. It's you know, so, of course, the pattern is a pattern of rage. But again, if you look at the shards of glass on the floor, you're not going to be looking for patterns. The truth is, we know that even those things fall in patterns. Because in the natural world, there are laws that govern all those things. When glass falls, there are patterns of distribution of the glass from the explosion or whatever it is, which are, in fact, can be calculated mathematically. Everything is like that. It's an amazing thing. So, but if you're looking for those patterns, that's because you have an assumption that there are patterns. You have an assumption there's one unifying intellect here. That's what we call God. So therefore, that's why Maimonides starts off his Mishneh Torah, and he says, the foundation of the foundations and the pillar of wisdom is to know that there is a God. The foundation of foundations of Judaism is to know there is a God. Why is it the pillar of wisdom? Maimonides says it's the pillar of wisdom because without the wisdom of God, how can you see patterns in anything? Why should you be looking for them? That's what Jacob was doing. The rabbis are telling us when Jacob took the stones of the place and they were arguing with each other, those stones represent the basic elements of the world and of creation. And the superficial worldview sees them as arguing. But the head of Jacob, Emet, the truth of Jacob, he puts his head on them. As soon as he does so, they become unified and one. That's the idea. That's another idea. Now, there's actually another idea. Actually, that's as far as I'm going to go with that midrash. I'll give you another example. Number seven. Number seven tells the following. It gives us three instances of famous donkeys. Right, three instances of famous donkeys. I'm sure you've heard of some of them. One donkey is, it says, Moses took his sons, his wife and sons, put them on the donkey and went down to Egypt. And then it says that Abraham, when he took Isaac to the sacrifice of Isaac, he put him on a donkey. It says the donkey. And it says also when the Messiah will come, he'll come riding on the donkey. So Rashi tells us, now each time it says the donkey, that's significant. Why? What's the difference between a donkey and the donkey? That's correct. If it's the donkey, it's a specific donkey. So you know what the Midrash says? It says, you know why it says the donkey? It's referring to the same donkey. The donkey that Abraham used in the year, Jewish year, about, 2048, is the same donkey that Moses used 400 years later. And it's the same donkey the Messiah will come on 3,300 years later. So you've got this ancient donkey, 4,000-year-old Eeyore. You can imagine why he's taking so long. Because this donkey is like, 3,000-year-old Mel Brooks, 3,000-year-old man. Here's the 3,000-year-old donkey. Does it make any sense to you? What, God needs to conserve donkeys? Make another donkey. Big deal. So one more donkey. I mean, what's the big deal? Would it be miraculous for a donkey to live that long? Of course. There are lichens and trees that can live for hundreds of years. Right? There are moles that can live for thousands. Right? Turtles can live for 200 years. I saw a turtle in the Philadelphia Zoo, 180 years old. Never. Philadelphia for 180 years. Anyway, so now... But basically, you've got this... It's unbelievable. So you've got this... This donkey, 3,000 years old. What lesson are they trying to teach us with this? So the answer is the following. The answer is this. We look at the world as being shaped by different people. The world consists of two elements. One element is called... Chomer. Chomer means matter, and the other is called Tsura, which means form. Matter and form. Matter means pure materialism. The raw material of creation. A lump of unformed clay we'd call Chomer, matter. What is Tsura? Tsura is shape. Shape is that which gives something purpose. You take clay and you model it into something useful, you've now given it form. You've given form to the matter. Now it can be used. Now it's got a purpose. Now it's got a goal. So what is the human purpose here? To take the raw material of the world and to shape it, to give it goal, to give it purpose. So this is how we look at life. You can look at the world from a materialistic point of view, Chomer. You can look at it from the point of view of Tzura, for example. I think William James uses this example in The Will to Believe. He said, supposing I would tell you, look, for $5, I'll sell you a ticket to an event tonight. You'll say, well, what's the event? So the event will be some catgut being scraped over horses' hairs. Sorry, horses' hairs being scraped over catgut. Would you be interested in that? $5? Not that expensive. So, of course you wouldn't be interested in that. Supposing I described the event a little differently. Would you like to come to a violin concert? Horse hair being scraped across cat gut? So, William James says, you see, when you start to think of things only in terms of the chomer, the matter, okay, it doesn't sound so great, does it?
When you think of things in terms of the tsura, the goal, the beautiful music, the violin concerto, right, then it's quite different, isn't it? So the world, we believe, is both chomer, cat, gut, and horse's hair, and it's tsura, beautiful music. It is our purpose to bring tsura, purpose, to the chomer, the material of the world. Now, the world, there were three people who did that. There are three people who are supposed to do that. I mean, an Israeli historian once said, that four Jews shaped the focus of the world. He said Moses focused the world on the intellect. Jesus focused the world on the heart. Karl Marx focused the world on the stomach. Freud lowered it further. But really, the focus of the world has to be on taking the matter, the materialism, and giving it purpose and goal. Purpose and goal. And the first person to do that was Abraham. Because Abraham brought down to the world the idea that there is a God. Monotheism. He was the originator. He was the one who brought to the world the concept of monotheism. In a sense, he was the first person. What is riding a donkey? You see, donkey is chamor, which means donkey. The Hebrew word for matter is chomer. It's the same letters. Chomer and chamor. The donkey represents matter. What does riding the donkey represent? If the donkey represents matter, what does riding the donkey represent? Controlling. What else? Shaping. What else? Giving direction. In other words, the chomer, the donkey, is matter. Who was the first person to bring to the world the ability to ride the donkey? It was Abraham. It was Abraham. He showed us that the donkey can be given direction, that the donkey has a purpose, that the donkey can be molded to that purpose. That's what Abraham showed us. So he was the first person to ride, and it's the same donkey. The second person to further enhance this lesson was Moses. Because what did Moses do? Moses brought down the Torah to the world. Moses showed us the exact direction. Moses was the GPS system. The Hertz never lost. Moses was the Rand McNally of donkeys. Right? The donkey has a direction. Abraham showed us, yes, the Moses has a direction. Moses showed us how to get there. Gave us the Torah. So he also, it doesn't say he rode the donkey, put his wife and children on the donkey, he led the donkey. Same thing. He controlled the donkey, he moved the donkey in the right direction. In other words, he shaped matter into form. Who is the third person who will fulfill that idea? The Mashiach. The Messiah will also be riding on a donkey. It doesn't mean that there's a 3,000-year-old donkey. It does not mean that. But each of us, in every generation, we all have our own particular donkey that we're trying to control and we're trying to ride. In every generation, there are also battles like this. In every generation, every person has to know how to give direction to their donkey, how to control. Not to kill the donkey, not to hurt the donkey, but to give the donkey direction, to show the donkey where to go. Every person has the donkey in the chomer, the matter within them, and through monotheism of Abraham, through the commandments and the Torah of Moses, and through the final hope for the Mashiach, then what we do is we take that donkey and make it go in the right direction. That's what is meant by that midrash. And indeed, we find there's another midrash similar to this. It says that when Moses stretched his hand out over the Red Sea, it's interesting, the verse says, Moses stretched his hand out over the sea, and he says God had a strong wind that blew the sea, and it turned the sea into dry land, and the waters split. Now, if you listen carefully, there's a discrepancy here. The subject of the sentence is the sea. And yet it changes to the water. So it starts off saying Moses lifted his rod out over the sea, and God made a wind blow on the sea, and then the sea turned into dry land, and then it switches, and what does it say? The water is split. So Midrash explains and answers, you know what it means by the water splitting? Every body of water in the world split. Every body of water. So you've got some Australian, 3,000 years ago the Jews got out of Egypt, he's walking along towards the Murrumbidgee River, that's what it's called, and suddenly it splits. And he says, oh, cool. And he walks across it and it carries on. Why would God do that? Why split every body of water? Does it make any sense? There's no use to it, A, and there's no record of it, B, and it's a miracle, which is unnecessary. Why do that? The answer the Maharal says is the following. He says, you see, if you wanted to find some substance that would symbolize matter without form, what would it be? Water. Why? That's right. Water has no shape of its own. Water takes on the form of the vessel that it's in. So water, therefore, represents what? Pure physicality. So now, when Moses took the Jews out of Egypt and he split the Red Sea, God split the Red Sea, we believe it wasn't just the Red Sea being split. We believe that it means, and this is what the rabbis mean, every physical barrier that will prevent the Jews from getting from Egypt to Israel will split. It doesn't matter what the particular Egypt is and the particular Israel is. Everyone has their Egypt, everyone has their Israel, and everyone has a Red Sea right in front of you. Many times in history, the Jews have had to get out of an Egypt and get to the land of Israel. And there's been Red Seas, numerous Red Seas in front of us. So many physical barriers to try to prevent the Jews from reaching their destiny, both on the individual level and on the national level. When God took us out of Egypt and split the Red Sea, and it says all the water is split, you know what it's saying? It's saying every physical barrier that will try to prevent the Jews from getting from Egypt to Israel will ultimately split like the Red Sea. And in our own lives also we believe that if we have to get to a holy land, to Israel, and we have to get out of an Egypt, and there are Red Seas in front of us, like they split then, so they will split in future, and so they will split for every person. Because everyone has got the ability to ride the donkey, everyone's got the ability to control, to give channel, and to give purpose to the donkey. And when we ride the donkey properly, and we know how to do that, then there is nothing ever physical that can prevent us from reaching across from Egypt to Israel, crossing the Red Sea. That's the message of the Midrash. The rabbis wrapped it in words, a mystery wrapped inside an enigma, etc., as Churchill said, right? They wrapped it in different terms, but they are telling us a message very important for our lives. The evil inclinations of fly, stones argue amongst each other, but there's inherent unity, and there's a 3,000-year-old donkey, and all the waters in the world split. Those are the lessons, those are the words of the lessons we try to give over today. That's how we understand Midrash. Thank you very much.